Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with Kirk about the most recent chapters that have been added to Yada Yah. It's the first time that I've attempted to move into future prophecy with Yada Yah. The first two chapters that were posted were about the war in Syria, where that is going to lead, and how that ultimately influences Yisrael, how it's going to be divided because of the consequence of the war in Syria, and that ultimately when the harvest that Christians use the misnomer rapture will occur. And so those were the first two chapters that were positioned, and then there were chapters on the history of Rome, because Yahweh brings it up. That there was one other aspect of that before we move on to the next chapter, is that, boy, I really saw a lot of similarities between Rome and the United States.
Can I do a quick aside note on
sure.
this? Because we have talked about that a tiny bit, but if you look at, okay, there's Rome apparently is fallen, or it doesn't, but it becomes more of a political animal, a religious
mm-hmm.
animal,
mm-hmm.
and it influences Europe. And
right.
then, of course, it finally gets, even though the English drop Catholicism, they mm-hmm. still are Catholic just without a pope, you know.
Right.
But at the height of the British Empire,
mm-hmm.
Did you know that the top artist in the country was a guy named Alma Tadema, and he was incredibly successful, and what he painted was pictures of Rome,
mm-hmm.
The Victorians in Roman garb and everything,
uh-huh.
Claudius
right.
picture, and they said the reason he was so successful, other than the fact he was a really great artist, is because the Victorians viewed themselves as the Roman Empire, as imperial.
Yes, yeah.
Rome.
Right. Look at the Holy Roman Empire that was, even through the 19th century and into the 20th century, were still perceived to be the basis of Europe. That's why Hitler called his crusade the Third Reich. I mean, because the first was Rome, Imperial Rome, then it was the Holy Roman Empire, and he was the third in succession of these things. So, absolutely. Yeah.
So, I mean, the parallels are just frightening. I mean, even I was watching the thing the other night on Mark Twain. You know, he wrote his book about he made his grand tour of the world in the latter part of the 1800s. And
yes.
he said, why do we want to go around and become an imperialist power and rape everybody and
right.
enslave everybody and take all their money?
Right. And that's what Rome was. Rome was an imperial power. I mean, that's why we come up with the whole concept of imperial power based on Rome.
Roman, yeah.
Right.
I mean, the tentacles of this thing can't die, won't die. I mean, it's
right.
and it's
yeah.
scary.
Yeah, one of the things, too, that I learned in that first review is that I had always thought that Constantine was the one that made the Christianity official. And that imposed in Christianity on Rome, but that's not correct. While Constantine's contribution, if you will, to evil was the Council of Nicaea, and we talk a lot about the Council of Nicaea and what it was about. But before we get to that, it was actually Theodosius who came into power about 60 to 70 years after Constantine. He's the one that imposed the Christian religion. He made it such that you were either Christian or you would die. He did the same thing that the Islamic State is doing in Iraq today.
Yeah.
You know, you either convert to our religion or we're going to cut off your head.
Yeah, I didn't realize that until I read that in your chapter there. So it was quite an eye-opener.
Yeah, and also Theodosius did something else, too. He was the one who came up with the feudal system, the lord and serf that
mm-hmm.
plagued Europe for better part of 1,000 years thereafter.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's really the more interesting character. The other thing was fascinating was the Council of Nicaea. And, you know, Christians are beguiled into believing the purpose of the Council of Nicaea was to codify the books of the New Testament, to set the canon, which they did not do, and then to come up with this Nicene Creed. First of all, the Greek name for the town, Nicaea, should send shivers up and down Christian spine when you say Nicene Creed, because it's the Greek god of victory. And all, the footwear company, Nike, is named after the same Greek god. But the entire purpose of the Council of Nicaea is only for one purpose, and that is that at that point the empire was fairly well split between what was called Arians and Catholics. Mm-hmm. And the Catholics wanted a completely different god, and they wanted a man that was totally God. And this god had to be totally disassociated from the author of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. So the purpose of the Council of Nicaea was to Arius, who was the leader of those who realized that, no, there's a direct connection. And the most you can say about Yahusha is he's a diminished manifestation of Yahweh, and therefore he's not the totality of God. That's not even remotely possible. And so for the new religion to take hold, the new Roman religion to take hold, they had to create a new god that was wholly and completely disassociated with the old god, and the man was the totality of God. That was the whole purpose of the Nicene Council.
And it could be sold to the masses because they already had that in Dionysus of Bacchus or whomever.
Right. Yep. And what they ended up doing is they created a completely disassociated god who was based entirely on Dionysus. And when you look at Hadrian's affinity for Dionysus, and you look at the Greek affinity for Dionysus, and how much everything associated with Dionysus is a perfect match for Christianity. Whoa, it's just flat out scary.
That's got to frighten people. I mean, if you read it, I mean, of course, most people won't read it, but that's
yes.
A shame. But you can't defend this stuff.
No.
You can no longer defend this stuff. Once you read it, once you see it, you go, oh.
Now, the second thing that struck me in the purpose of the second chapter was Yahweh was saying that Rome doesn't die, that while the beast will suffer a fatal blow, that this beast comes back and it ends up influencing and trampling upon the whole world. So now what you see is the transformation, and there's only one explanation for this. It's the transformation from empire to church.
Mm-hmm.
And so the second chapter was really to describe that transformation. But, I mean, if you read God's testimony here, it's impossible not to see the church as the beast. And you know, I know there's a lot of people out there that are Protestants that like to say that it's the Roman Catholic Church, but there was only one Christianity at the time. There is, at this point in time that the transition is made, there is only one Christianity. And that became the beast.
Yeah, and Protestantism is not that far from the tree, so who's kidding who?
Absolutely. And what you find, too, is that the Catholic Church is really based upon in fact, the Eastern Orthodox, what we call now the Eastern Orthodox churches, which are, a quarter the size of Roman Catholicism today, that they actually were the basis of Roman Catholicism, that Roman Catholicism, Rome in the sense of Empire of Rome, Catholicism in terms of universality, was imposed by Theodosius, and Theodosius was the last to be over the unified Eastern and Western Roman Empire, but he ruled out of the East.
Constantinople.
Yeah, so he imposed what we consider to be Roman Catholicism, universal Roman Christianity. But it's Eastern Orthodox and so what you see is that there really is no difference. So if you're going to label the beast, you can't leave out all of the Eastern Orthodox churches, of which the Russian Orthodox is part of that, Macedonian is part of that, the Greek Orthodox Church is part of that, all of that.
Yeah.
And they're equally culpable to the Roman Catholic Church.
Sure. Well, they don't change very much, even, you know, even when the King of England breaks away because of his divorce situation.
Right.
He didn't change anything. I mean, it was the Scots and their Lutheranism and everything that maybe did a slight change in procedure. But they all say the Nicene Creed.
Correct.
They're all bound together on their thought pattern on the Trinity,
right,
and everything else. So, I mean, it's the same guy.
Yeah, the only two differences is, A, who's in charge, whether it's the king or queen of England or a pope in Rome, or the Copt pope in Cairo. It's who's in charge is one, and there are differences as to how universally they incorporate the Queen of Harry, the Queen of Heaven and Mother of God, how big a deal Mary plays. And the Eastern Orthodox and the Roman Catholics, she plays the same role.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, but in Protestant Christianity, she plays a lesser role.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about it.
But not in the art.
No, not in the art. That is,
they do it subtly. They do it to you subtly. There's always, right, there's mom and baby. That's bigger than, you know.
So in that second chapter, the purpose of it was, I was struggling to understand. And we talked about that in the first hour of the program today. I was struggling to understand how it was possible for a religion so obviously false. You know, if you created a religion and then you were, that religion was wholly adversarial. I mean, viewed the basis of the religion as an enemy. You know, here is Yosha. He's a Jew. He's observing the Torah. And yet you create a religion that is universally opposed to Jews and that outlaws the Torah. How do you do that and convince people that it can be true? And so the second chapter was to explain what was going on in Rome, what was going on in Greece that enabled them to be beguiled into accepting a religion that was obviously false.
Are you ever surprised why they kept some of the books in that they kept in? I mean, is, you know, or why they kept an Old Testament with a New Testament?
I mean,
you got to go that route. Why not just get rid of the whole, almost the whole thing? I mean,
because you know, Paul in Romans and Galatians says that, you know, the Torah is penalizing. The Torah is enslaving. The Torah can't save. That the Torah has been done away with. It's been annulled. It's now dead. So why even have a book that is so egregious from your religious perspective? When we study the culture in which Christianity took root, that was wholly uprooted, severed from the only credible, truthful past, that Christianity is not a religion that grows out of the history of the people of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. As a matter of fact, you really can't call Christianity an Abrahamic religion because it's opposed to the covenant with Abraham, and it's opposed to the Israelites, the descendants of Jacob. And so you can't, that was just so mind-boggling to me to go through how Rome and Greece, which the Romans loved Hellenistic ideas and philosophy, particularly Gnosticism, but how the culture of Rome was specifically created so that a religion like Christianity could take root in it and really become Roman Christianity, as opposed to, based upon the Hebrew lineage.
You know, Terry came in just a second ago and said to me, you know, she grew up Catholic, and she said, mm-hmm, you know, we were never given a Bible. We were never given an Old or a New Testament. We were given, mm-hmm, of course, a catechism and the laws of the church and a missal.
Right. Uh-huh.
And that took precedent over everything, so it didn't matter what they said if they read it. You know, it would have been overruled. By their church doctrine, and if I recall, I mean, I was a little kid, went to Presbyterian Church, and they have a catechism, and the Baptists certainly have one.
Right.
And they teach that in Sunday school before you can join the church.
Right.
You know, you have
correct.
Kids that have to learn this stuff and take a test on it, and then you can
right.
join
exactly.
the church. So,
exactly.
President. So it doesn't really matter what else you give them. I say this is the truth. Everything else is confusing.
But what you'll find is that the Roman Catholic canon and the Presbyterian Catechism are really in lockstep with Paul's letters.
Yeah.
I mean, Paul wrote to the Romans as a Roman, Greek ideals, which the Romans loved. I mean, he based his whole of the spirit of the flesh on Gnosticism. He gave them what they already believed. That's why it was so popular. That's why it was accepted.
Now, in your history, how much of this rang a bell? I mean, when you were like my grandfather, he was an elder in the Presbyterian Church. I mean, like
uh-huh.
you, and how much of that registered with you, or did you question that at all, or did it bug you at times? I know where you started, but this journey, but
I went and you began this by correctly stating I went in with a perspective. I have always been curious as to how the religion of Christianity could be so disjointed. You know, the Presbyterian Church is hugely anti-Israel. They are hugely pro-mythical people known as Palestinians and therefore embracing Islam. Mm-hmm. And so the church that I belong to is second probably in repulsiveness. You know, I think that the Roman Catholic Church is primary in repulsiveness, but the Presbyterians are really fighting for a position right there at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to answer your question, Kirk, is that I have long since gotten over my hostility with myself, my disappointment with myself for what I did as an elder and an evangelist in the Presbyterian Church. And so there is that battle, that part of me that was so polluted with Pauline Christianity and anti-Semitism. My father was an anti-Semite, so I grew up in that culture. After having written Questioning Paul and disassociating myself from Pauline Christianity completely, that part of my life is just no longer resonates. I had to deal with how disappointed I was and who I had been. But that now is 5 or 6 years ago. And so, no, in writing this chapter, my whole purpose was, can I demonstrate, can I actually create an understanding? And I was trying to do it for myself and figured that's kind of how I write anyway, is trying to understand myself. And then if I can find some things that are unique insights that are helpful, then I'll just share it with other people. And if they benefit too, so much the better. But, I mean, I write for myself. I really want to understand. And so I wanted to understand how it was possible that a religion so obviously false could beguile billions of people. And so the purpose of that second chapter was to do that very thing. When we come back, we do have Glenn back on the line, and I want to get his input here. But did I make the case in that second chapter? I do want your input on that, Kirk, because I think I did. I mean, but, you know, I'm prejudiced. I sought to understand. I thought I put together the basis for that understanding in the second chapter. But I'd like your input as to whether or not you're convinced. Barnum of Ringing Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus is attributed with the statement, I don't know if he actually made it or not, says you can fool all of the people some of the time. You can fool some of the people all of the time. But you can't fool all of the people all of the time. And yet what we see in the birth of Christianity is all of the people being fooled for thousands of years. The question is, were they actually fooled, or was it just like the Islamic State today in Iraq? Go along or die. So before we hear Glenn's comment, Kirk, I don't think there's anyone who has ever attempted to explain how Christianity could have grown to billions of people as a religion completely uprooted from its past, where it had to create a completely artificial past for the religion to prevail. that someone took the time to say, all right, how did that happen? What transpired in Rome and in Greece to enable that kind of a myth to prevail?
Well, no one's done it quite that concise as you've done it, but to answer your question, what I thought so valuable, besides just insights to me, was that, like today, if IQ, as intelligent as he is, would read this, not mm-hmm. questioning Paul, not all the other, but he should, but that one, if he would just read this, you know how most of the time IQ, and we love him dearly, but
yes.
he seems to can't figure out why do Americans, why do Europeans, why do Christians
right.
think the way they think. This is the most concise thing as far as explaining why our philosophy is what it is, why we follow these dictates, why we think the way we do. It's very obvious when you read it. I mean, the influence of Roman Empire, Roman Church, Roman tentacles direct us in that way. They've just...
It's your appraisal, and
yes,
you know
sir.
We're friends. We're brothers. We're friends. You know, I'm not expecting you to be unbiased here, but it's your appraisal, as biased as you may be, because we are friends. That the second chapter, which explained how Christianity could grow as a myth based upon completely revisionist history. Completely uprooted from its own soil and land, it's your view that it not only explains how that occurred, but explains who we are as a world today. It explains what people's perspectives are in America and in Europe today.
Yeah, absolutely. No good question. That's not being friendly. I'm talking about that's absolutely, you nailed it. You know, it was. I would have taken a lot more words to say it, but that you said a lot as precise as possible. I mean,
I don't want to come across as too strong here, but I can tell you that as I was comprising this analysis of the culture of Roman Greece that made Christianity possible, I felt that I was uncovering insights that maybe hadn't been considered. And hadn't been connected for a very long time, that if thoughtfully considered would provide enormous amount of perspective for people reading it today. I was very encouraged by that. I found far more connections and far more insights than I ever suspected.
Yeah. You know, it's more than I'm. You could throw a line down the legal pad and say this is Rome and this is us, this is so and so, this is Christianity.
Right.
You know, you can do those kind of comparison charts, but it was more on why we think that way and how that
reveals
what it does. I mean, the result of our thinking,
right.
of our bad thinking, as opposed
right.
to our proper studying of the Torah, leads you to this.
And I've seen lots of comparisons on behavior and result. Rome, America, for example, Rome, Roman Catholicism, also as an example. What I've never seen is what is the root?
Yeah.
What was the cause for that effect? And what is it that shaped the thinking or lack of thinking? What caused the belief system and the perspective that was so jaundiced, so untrue?
Yeah.
Glenn, I know you just, you've called back in and I wanted to get your insights into to this. You probably have not yet read those new chapters. I'd love for you to and to provide comment on them, but you've been following this discussion. What are your thoughts?
I kind of chuckled when you said 100 pages. It's hardly a Herculean undertaking in academic terms.
No.
It shouldn't be too burdensome. The thing is, it's I'm guessing, I know I haven't read it, but very deliberate and purposeful polemic. So, and you have you're illustrating, making the point with an abundance of data. So, yeah, I get that.
Yeah, there's actually the two chapters are probably 350 pages, but there's just the review of Roman wars is a little over 100 pages.
Right, gotcha. But the reason I called in initially was you were talking about the transitioning from the empire to the church, the wounded head and that sort of thing.
Yes.
And what, you know, what we see is the building of the church, and that the church had civil power for centuries, and that even when the civil power of the Roman church was diminished,
right,
it still functioned as this hotbed of coals that would periodically ignite the wood of the civil government placed on top of it. And that's precisely what we see in the British Empire and the American Empire. And as an illustration, I just always love to point this out. The Roman Senate met on Capitoline Hill. The American Senate meets on Capitol Hill.
Correct.
And if you watch C-SPAN and catch anything going on in the House of Representatives, you will see on either side of the podium of the House of Representatives depictions of the Roman fasces. Now,
yes,
that's not an accident.
No.
You know.
Oh, no. The connections, the actual connections between Rome and the United States and Imperial Rome, it's frightening.
It's all been engineered over time. I mean, from the time,
correct,
if you go back to the reign of Queen Elizabeth I and time of John Dee and his idea of bringing about the British Empire, you know, you had the English, you talk about the church, well, you had the Anglican church, but it's still the same hotbed of coals igniting that firewood of the British Empire placed on top.
Correct. Yeah, Britain, America, Italy during its heyday, Rome, Greece, it's the same old story over and over again, and it's a brutal story. It's an extraordinarily ungodly story.
And the
only purpose of the religion of Rome was to create a patriotic tie between the government, the military, using the religion. The religion was used to create a patriotic political affinity for this militaristic government. Very much like the integration between the religion and the military in America. You know, with its chaplains and God bless America and let's pray for our troops and all of that sort of thing and all of the patriotic songs that integrate God into, you know, onward Christian soldiers. I mean,
just call it civil religion.
Yeah, it's civil religion.
Civil religion. Yeah.
You know, when you know, I've always wondered why Yahweh in the first requirement of the covenant. I know he doesn't say don't walk away from religion because there is no Hebrew word for religion. But his first comment is walk away from your country.
Right.
What you realize is that when you consider Rome and Babylon and Persia and Greece, is there was no distinction whatsoever between military, politics, patriotism, and religion.
Well,
they were all integrated.
I would suggest that in the story of Yahusha being taken up on a high mountain, being offered all the kingdoms of the world by the adversary, I would suggest that he wasn't offering him just the kingdoms of the world at that time, but all the kingdoms of the world down through history.
Right, for all time.
Because they've always been corrupted. And so that principle holds. I do have to go. One note on your personal biographical background.
Mm-hmm.
As someone who did a semester at Westminster, I know where you're coming from.
Yes. Yeah. And there's a period of time when you're making the disconnect between your past. There's a period of time that you're very, at least I know you have been, I have been. I was really disappointed in myself. And I was even angry at myself.
Well, you know, there's a sense in which you can get, like, conversion fatigue. When you start out as a young person and you start, well, I mean, I went east and everything. You had, you know, the big influence of the Eastern religions. When I was sort of a secularized nothing in my youth, you had Harvey Cox's turning east,
right,
you know, so we had to, I considered Eastern philosophies, Western stuff, evangelicalism, kind of Pentecostalism.
Yep.
And after a while, you get embarrassed that you're changing so much.
Right.
And, you know, horrified
by how easily you were beguiled. But after a while, and I sense this with you, I sense it with Kirk, and I know I have it in myself, I have moved past the guilt. I am no longer disappointed in myself. I'm no longer feel the frustration and the guilt for not only having been wrong, but promoted wrong for so long. And I'm really now grateful for that past because it empowers me, helps me, guides me to be a much more effective in criticizing it.
But it's and it's good to encounter it, but let's not forget that Yahweh's forgiving, loving,
right.
You know,
right. And
you
in fact, what I'm thinking about as I'm having this conversation with you, Glenn, is that is the almost all of Yahweh's instructions to us about not being religious, about not doing these things, are all written in the imperfect. And in the imperfect, what it says is don't habitually do it. Don't continue to do it, which is the moment that I stopped, the moment I realized that I was wrong and changed direction, that I was no longer accountable, no longer guilty of what I had done in the past. And it takes you a while to metabolize that, if you will. But that's the beauty of it's ultimately liberating. And so the answer to Kirk's question is, yeah, I was right at the pinnacle of all of this evil and was not just a recipient and a victim of it. I was a promoter of it. I was a victimizer.
Right. Right, right. And to go, like, to kind of put a little Niebuhr in here, you know, Reinhold Niebuhr, the Niebuhrs, it's not just a matter of coming away from your nation state. In an era when nation state authority is being poo-pooed and we're being told to think global, act locally, it's a matter of mentally and emotionally dissociating from your umbrella culture. It's also not
right.
just, the, not just the nation, but the worldly culture.
Yeah, that's actually the second aspect of what Yahweh asks us to walk away from. It's literally our culture, the traditions, because the traditions and culture are a combination of all these things. That's why I thought, and if you read the chapters, and Kirk, I know you have, that whole imposition of the censor and what the role of the Roman censor was and the influence of the Roman censor, particularly as it relates to Yahusha, something Glenn said at the end of the last segment brought back an interesting aspect of Roman history that I was unaware of. One of the most important offices in Rome was the office of the censor. And it was not imposed to take a census. It was an office that existed to impose what we would call today political correctness, so that your words, your actions were all in harmony with the Roman religion, the Roman politics, Roman militarism, the Roman caste system. That if you said or did anything that was out of context with those things, even if you didn't break any law, it was the censor's job to try you and to kill you was the consequence. And so, for example, with Pontius Pilate, when he reviewed Yahusha, he said, I don't find any guilt in him. And he says, you know, he's innocent, but he was innocent of Roman law. He was not innocent of the Roman thought police when he indicated that he was divine, which is why he was still flogged and killed by the Romans. And so what we see in Rome is this office, and I spent a lot of time talking about it, that had a mandate to impose what we would call today political correctness, that you either go along with a national religion, a national political thought process, and national morality. So it was a morality police. Did you see parallels between that and what we're experiencing today?
The media, but I could see where they could take it a step further and actually put it into a civil court and fine you or send you to jail for things like this.
Well, you know, today, if you go against the thought police, the moral police, political correctness, you can't have a job in the media. You can't have a job in politics. You can't have a job in academia. And even if you're apart from those things, you'll be criticized and attacked. And today, you're just not allowed to say things. Yeah, that are against the moral police. And the moral police today, the national religion is political correctness, socialist, secular, humanism.
Can I add one little quickie, because I know we're in the last little period? As you listen to the show all week, I have to listen some to it on tape afterwards or on archives.
Mm-hmm.
However, you get 4 or 5 hours a week on attacking Paul, which is wonderful, But then, for those of us who actually listen in on the Friday night show, when you get, we're right now with the 119 Psalm, and then you get Dode's love of the Torah, and you get 4 or 5 hours of Paul hating the Torah, and you put the two together, and you do a comparison of those two, and you go, who are you going to listen to? I mean, this is just, I mean, just... The opposites are so phenomenal. You could, why would you listen to Paul?
Yeah, in fact, all of our listeners here, I would encourage you to participate in the Friday afternoon or evening show, depending if you're West Coast or East Coast. It's 7:30. Start 7:30 Eastern time this evening, or 4:30 Pacific time this evening, and we're focused on the most important song ever written, the lyrics of which, the 119th Psalm, explain how to observe the Torah, which is the most important document ever written. And so when you listen to Dode, who is David, view insights into what you should focus on the Torah and how to observe the Torah and the benefits of observing the Torah, and you compare them to what Paul said, particularly in Romans, where he is calling the Torah a plague of death, it's the source of all evil, that it's enslaves, and that in Galatians it is pornography. And what you realize is that they're saying exactly the opposite thing. One is saying that the Torah I love, it's the most important thing in my life. That's Dode. And Yahweh says of Dode, you know, he's going to model eternity after Dode. I mean, it's the person that Yah loves most of all men of all time. And then you have Paul saying, but I say, and he besmirches the Torah, calls it the nastiest, most revolting document in the world. Yeah, pornography. And so this is the point that I was trying to make earlier, is how do you have a religion based upon Paul's letters that is completely contradictory to the Torah that is the beginning of Christian Bibles, and have people go along with that as if, well, that's not a problem. They just said the opposite thing. You can open a Christian Bible. The 119th Psalm is there, and so is Paul's letters to the Galatians and the Romans. They are exact opposites. You know, if one is true, the other is false. And there is no chance whatsoever that Paul's version can be true, because it is constantly contradicted by God. So who are you going to believe? You're going to believe God, or are you going to believe that one man?